So, welcome to the German Historical Institute and to our debate on Max Weber's work and its relation to historical writing. Thank you very much for coming. I know it's Christmas time, but I'm sure you'll get a very interesting evening here this evening. And the occasion, of course, for this debate is the fact that it's the 150th anniversary of Max Weber's birthday this year. This birthday was in April, but 2014 being the year of the anniversaries, the First World War, and then the tercentenary of the Union of Grounds of Great Britain and Hanover pushed Max Weber slightly out of the way and towards the end of the year, but definitely not the least important event we have to commemorate this year, or want to commemorate this year. Max Weber has many connections, or we have many connections, we have to put it the other way around. We have many connections to Max Weber. The German Historical Institute belongs to a foundation which has been renamed the Max Weber Foundation recently. It's the German Institutes in the Humanities Abroad. And in 2010, I think, we finally decided to replace the acronym DGIR, which no one can actually pronounce, by Max Weber Foundation. And everyone seems to have known this foundation for ages. Whenever we say we belong to the Max Weber Foundation, everyone says, ah, yeah. And in fact, it's only it came into being very recently. But of course, this institute had a long-standing tradition of Max Weber research when Wolfgang Mommsen was director here at the Institute in the late 70s and 80s. He was an eminent scholar of Max Weber, and he did his PhD on Max Weber and German politics, 1890 to 1920, a PhD which was published in 1959 and caused considerable uproar in Germany, because he sort of criticized, or was, one could say criticized Max Weber, or at least laid open that he was a nationalist in many ways. Even after having become a Democrat, he still adhered to certain nationalist politics. However, Mommsen was very influential in Weber scholarship. He was part of the Max Weber Gesamtausgabe, and he held a very memorable conference here at the Institute in 1984 on Max Weber and his contemporaries, which resulted in a volume. The books are out there in our vitrine. You can have a look at it afterwards, which put Max Weber into the context of the turn of the century intellectual world in Germany and beyond. And so, taking up this tradition, we would like to talk tonight about Max Weber and his work, and particularly under the aspect of its relation to history, historiography, historical writing. And Max Weber, in his famous Science as a Vocation, wrote, "In the realm of science, the only person to have personality, in inverted commas, he called it, is the one who is wholly devoted to his subject." And he continued, "If a man appears on the stage as the impresario of the subject to which he devotes himself, and if he attempts to legitimate himself by appealing to his personal experience, this is not enough to turn him into a personality. I have to admit this evening that I'm the impresario. I have read Max Weber, but I'm not a scholar of Max Weber. But I'm very glad to be able to present three real Weber personalities in the field to eminent experts who have worked on Max Weber and devoted many years of their life to the study of various aspects of his work or his life. And I just very briefly introduce alphabetically on my left Professor David Dabre. He's Professor of History at University College London, did his training in Cambridge and PhD in Oxford. He is mainly a medievalist and worked widely on medieval marriage and papacy and many other fields of medieval history, but he has also a profound interest in a certain aspect of Max Weber, which particularly relates to rationality, which is the core aspect of Max Weber's work. He wrote two books, Rationalities in History, which deals very widely with the topic of rationality, and also a second volume related to that, Rationalities, Medieval Religious Rationalities. And secondly, it's Peter Gosch. He is from Oxford and a fellow of St. Anne's College in Oxford. He's a specialist in the history of ideas, in particularly with relation to Britain, but also Europe. He worked, and also of historiography. He worked widely on Gibbon, Macaulay, and many other aspects of British intellectual history. And for the last probably 1.5 decades, he devoted himself to Max Weber, particularly to the Protestant ethic. He is editing a new translation of the Protestant ethic, and has now very recently published the book Max Weber and the Protestant Ethic, Twin Histories, not Parallel Lives, but Twin Histories. Wonderful. And finally, on my right, you are very well equipped. We can put them all here. So that's the Twin Histories. And on my right is Joachim Radkau, who studied in Münster, Berlin, and Hamburg, did his PhD with Fritz Fischer. That is, sort of takes us back to the First World War again. And but he did his PhD on German immigrants 33 to 45 and their influence on American politics towards Europe. He then changed to Bielefeld, the sort of the temple of Weber research or application with Hans-Ulrich Wehler as his Habilitationsvater. But in between, he also worked with George Hallgarten on German history. Hallgarten himself was a pupil of Max Weber, so Joachim Radkau has sort of some sort of apostolic succession, I suppose, in the field of Weber. But most of all, he wrote, besides many other things, coming out of a major work at the end of the 90s, Das Zeitalter der Nervosität, The Age of Anxiety, Germany between Bismarck and Hitler. And after that, he devoted himself to several biographies, and one of them was Max Weber, and a biography, the German title, subtitle is Die Leidenschaft des Denkens, the Passion of Thinking. And very recently, he published in 2013 a biography of Theodor Heuss, the first German president, which is about to receive the Einhard Prize, Charlemagne's biographer. We have three personalities in the Weberian sense, scholars who have worked for a long time and very intensively on and with Max Weber, and it's a pleasure for me to have you here, and thank you very much for coming, and I'm sure we'll have a lively debate. We will open it up after a while into a general debate. The topic, Max Weber's work and its relation to historical writing, has of course many facets. I have sort of the sake of sort of keep this somehow under control, the debate, and focused. I have divided it up in three aspects, into three aspects. It's basically Max Weber and his relation to historical writing can be viewed under the perspective what have historians written on Max Weber, and the other aspects could be how are historians using Max Weber, and the third aspect is Max Weber himself as a historian. How much was he a historian? So that is the three sort of set of questions which I proposed to the three panelists, and I would like to start with the third aspect, Max Weber as a historian or as a historical thinker in general, which is slightly wider. And in Friedrich Tenbruck's essay on Max Weber and Eduard Meyer, Eduard Meyer was an historian of ancient history, German historian, contemporary of Max Weber. And in this paper, which was in fact based or given at this conference here, Max Weber and his contemporaries at the German Historical Institute, there's a passage entitled Max Weber as a historian, and it starts with the following sentence. Wer ernsthaft an das Werk Max Webers herantritt, sieht sich vor die Frage gestellt, wie aus dem Historiker, als der Weber antrat, der Soziologe werden konnte, als den er sich spät und zögernd zu bezeichnen begann. Ihre Beantwortung dient nicht einem antiquarischen Interesse, sie geben vielmehr Aufschluss über das Rätsel, wie Max Weber seine Soziologie gemeint hat. In sort of free translation, who wants to study Max Weber seriously has to be confront himself with the question how he turned from the historian as what he started into a sociologist, and that this is more than a purely academic question, it is actually a key to the sociology of, to the understanding of Max Weber's sociology. And I would like to pose my first question to Peter Gosch and ask him, to what extent do you actually regard Weber as a historical thinker? A historical thinker is, of course, not necessarily the same as a historian. It's in the wider sense that he is basically a historical theorist and has a vision of history as a whole.
Not a small question. And I would have to say, I think actually this is quite a neglected question, that you have to go quite a long way back in the literature to find people writing about Weber als Historiker. Funnily enough, given the words you've just used, Weber did actually classify himself as a historian in the broad sense, but not in the narrow sense, by which he meant that he was not a Fachhistoriker. You know, he wasn't actually in a history faculty. And he also meant, which is obviously pretty important, that he did not, to put it in vulgar language, he was not an adherent of the principle of studying the past for its own sake. And therefore he does see himself as quite consciously, on the one hand, he's extremely committed to historical method, and yet he knows perfectly well he's not a conventional historian. In fact, Andreas Gestrich says, well, as was saying to me, well, for example, how might one compare with Marx? In this context, I think that's actually quite a good comparison, because, again, I'm sure nobody needs to be told again that Marx, again, is in some sense historical, but nobody, again, would call him an ordinary or conventional historian by any stretch of the imagination. The difference, and it is still a very big difference between Weber and Marx, is that trying to do what is really a historical construction of the whole of modernity, of moderna Kultur, This is not, as I said, an empirical historical exercise, but it's become much harder than it was for Marx. And the reason it's become much harder is really simply that 50 years have passed, and the sheer volume of professional historical output has gone up by the most prodigious amount. And it's perfectly clear that you can't do what, approximately speaking, Marx and Hegel did, where you have a fairly, an intelligent layperson's grasp of certain crucial outlines of European history, and you can clothe your philosophy of history around that. And I'm sure all of you here who have ever looked at Weber will know that although Weber was not a historian in the narrow sense, he certainly knew an enormous amount of history and was very, very anxious to root his historical work. He's very anxious to cite evidence and to show that he really has read an enormous amount. Again, one of his great objections to Hegel is he says, well, Hegel is ultimately a panlogist. That Hegel is clothing history around a logical scheme. And whilst for Weber there's no question that what he calls Occidental or Western history does indeed have very distinct outlines, Weber's claim is that those outlines are absolutely empirical, that he's not in any way inventing it according to some Hegelian scheme. The point, therefore, the really crucial point to which I would want to draw attention, and this is the thing that really differentiates Weber from any conventional historian, of course, is that Weber is absolutely unremitting about the idea, about his premises. Why is he interested in history at all? To which the only answer is, because I wish to explain the present day. Allow me to quote to you from the very famous essay on objectivity, written in 1904. The first premise is that history in itself, or the events of history, are simply meaningless. There's a wonderful passage where he's sort of affecting slightly the Old Testament note, where he says, the stream of immeasurable happening, or geschehen, rolls endlessly into the face of eternity. And he's definitely wanting to tell you that there's no way this has any intrinsic pattern whatsoever. And that is his opening to say, in which case, then, we have to construct meaning. And we construct it quite explicitly from the perspective of the present day. And if, for example, it's only the most pronounced example, if you look at the Protestant ethic, it is littered with him saying, well, from the perspective of our perspective, our interests, that which interests us. He says this about 40 times in the text, just in case you have any doubt. Coming on then to the second point raised by the Tenbrook quotation, what is the relationship between history and sociology? I would wish to say, since as a matter of fact I'm not a sociologist, that I think we have to be very, very careful to disentangle the what Weber would have called the Gesortspatriotismus, the departmental patriotism of the sociologists. Again, as I'm sure is well known, Weber doesn't take up the word sociology until, in his mid-40s, in circa 1908-1909. And the sociologists undoubtedly equate the adoption of the label sociology with saying, well, aha, this shows that Max Weber has now joined a sociology department. And I have to say, I'm afraid I really don't believe that, that if you read classically an essay like the Objectivity essay, it's perfectly clear Weber is talking there about social science. And indeed, all the essential premises of what is called the Verstehende Soziologie are in fact laid out in the essay on Knies in 1905-1906. So the short answer to the Tenbrook question is that Weber is always historically minded in this very peculiar way, and he's always, obviously, I think, a social thinker. And if I may, as it were, therefore try to find a point of agreement with conventional literature, the conventional description of him as a historical sociologist is absolutely fair. I think that's entirely reasonable. The only thing I just don't want to say is it is not the case that he really went from history to sociology. Is that quite enough?
Okay, thank you very much. I posed the same question to you, Joachim Radkau, and you approached Weber from a completely different angle, from a biographical angle, perspective, and you wrote a lot about his life, also his difficulties, his passions. And some critics say you wrote more about his passions than about his intellectual biography. But of course, these are also interesting aspects. Anyway, how do you perceive, from your perspective, the importance of history for Weber? And was he a historical thinker?
First, thank you for your invitation, and please excuse my clumsy English, but Max Weber had the same difficulty with speaking English. I think it was a good idea from you to start with Friedrich Tenbruck's paper here 30 years ago. I read it again. Here I have copies of this pages. I felt myself more and more in the tradition of Friedrich Tenbruck and Wilhelm Hennis. Friedrich Tenbruck and Wilhelm Hennis attacked each other, most Weberians attack each other, but in one point they agreed that Max Weber more and more had an affinity to an anthropology. This is also the point in the paper he held here 30 years ago. Eduard Meyer, in his introduction to his ancient history, had a long chapter on anthropology, and it seems the statement of Tenbruck seems convincing to me that Max Weber take over many thoughts, even into his Wirtschaft und Gesellschaft, the economy and society. To be sure, Max Weber started in the historical school of economics in Germany, but more and more he criticized this theory of stages of evolution in history. I agree with Peter Gosch. Surely he was far away from Hegel and the Hegelian construction of history, but also Leopold von Ranke, the founding father of German historiography, hated really Hegel. This philosophical construction of history was just the contrary to what was empirical historical research should do. I think, indeed, this anthropology seems to me to be the key for Max Weber's later great works, Economy and Society, and Wirtschaftsethik der Weltregion, Economic Ethics of World Religions. And it was for Max Weber also a chance for a combination of his history and sociology, a combination of great concepts with a variety of the historical reality, which Max Weber liked very much. Of course, I agree with Peter Gosch. Surely he was no historian in the narrow sense, but apparently he liked history. He liked history very much. But I think at this point I do not agree with you. I think Max Weber's love for history did not only grow out of a rational calculation. I read some sentences of my book. Marianne, his wife, noted on him. He was in the 1918 when he had lectures in Vienna. He was asked about the reasons for his passionate emotion, example giving in presenting such distant problems as the Indian caste system. Admittedly, his account ended at a point where light was unexpectedly cast on problems close to us today. But all he could say was, "Oh, well, those things are so fabulously interesting." I think Max Weber was a very curious man, and many Weberians who only like to construct the reality from a theoretical concept don't realize this, don't esteem thing. Curiosity was for him a drive that did not need to be justified by a theory or some practical benefit. I must confess on myself, my approach from Max Weber also was forced by curiosity. Later on, I had systems to justify, to legitimize it. You know, I came from Bielefeld University, the stronghold of in social history, sociology, in Niklas Luhmann and Ulrich Wehler, structural history, and at first it was somewhat obscene to write a biography of Bielefeld historian, but I could defend it with a statement of Marc Bloch, the founding father of an art school, was also a holy man for the Bielefeld school. Marc Bloch wrote, "The good biographer resembles the cannibal of legend. When he scans human flesh, he knows his prey will to be not far off." I think, in order to write a real biography, you cannot only write an intellectual biography, especially in the case of Max Weber. There was no sharp division between rationality and emotions. And also in Max Weber's concept of history, there's not at all a sharp division between rational motives and religious or emotional motives.
This gives me a very good point to come over to pass on to David Davray when we are talking about rationalities and the division between different types of rationalities. That is your theme. But going back first to the question of the historical thinker, of course, Max Weber is always somehow associated with rise of Western rationality, grand designs of the rise of the West. You have your problems with these sort of constructions and with people who look at Max Weber primarily as a theorist of Western development, but you employ his categories of rationality in a non-developmental way. But do you still think that he is all the same important as a historical thinker in the sense of a sort of overarching vision of design of historical development?
I do. In fact, I think he's almost a model of what historical work should become, and it hasn't yet. And this is partly because to do history the way he did it is very, very difficult. But I think that the moment is ripe in the sense that global history is now very fashionable. And what Max Weber ended up doing was global history, but not as now on broadly narrative principles, but on analytical principles. So we're used to the idea of works of history of a particular period, which may be analytical in that they follow a thematic division. But that is what Max Weber did for world history in his final work. You see how much of a historian he is, if you compare him, say, with your Bielefelder Niklas Luhmann, who is a powerful social thinker, but absolutely incapable of thinking concretely. And if he had had that same capacity, he would have been twice the sociologist he was. I think he couldn't do it. And that combination is very rare. Now, my picture of Act Weber is very, very different from Peter Gosch's, very strikingly different, but I think we're not necessarily contradicting each other, because Peter Gosch has focused especially on the Protestant ethic. And I've spent enormous amounts of time studying the economy and society, Wirtschaft and Gesellschaft, so much so that I remember at one point I was marking the page divisions of the fourth edition, of the fifth edition onto the fourth edition, because I had annotated the fourth edition, and then I realized that the pages were different, so I marked every page so that I could refer to it. So, and I think he had, this was when my wife said to me, I think there are three of us in this marriage. But I think Max Weber evolves, and what he ends up with is an analytical historian of world history, and at that point, the difference between the sociologist and the historian almost disappears. Now, I think his trajectory is something like this. He did indeed start, as Peter Gosch says, by this preoccupation with how the West came to be so different. The rise of capitalism, the rise of the special bureaucracy of the West, the national state, all of those things, how it came to be so different, the West and the rest. And he started to study other cultures because he properly said, how can we see why it's so different unless we look at other societies? As time went on, he became so interested in the other societies that that interest took on a life of its own, so much so that, in fact, you begin to find him almost reversing the question and saying, how did Indian asceticism come to be so different, so much more evolved than the West? There's a fantastic passage in Weber where he says the most rationally developed asceticism in the world is Indian asceticism, just as you might say about bureaucracy. But he's saying the asceticism is more rational because they found more ways to torture the body, more elaborate, calculated ways to do it than they did in the West. So a lot in that, he's saying that that is rationalization. And he became as interested in that as the rest. Now, I think where it all came together for him in economy and society was that as a sociologist, he was not looking for scientific type laws. He was looking for ideal types which are law-like. And everybody thinks they know what ideal types are, but I think people haven't penetrated them enough. There's a philosopher, Donald Davidson, who's written very similarly about laws governing human behavior, which correlates with that. But what he meant by ideal types were they were laws that don't always apply, but they mostly apply, and especially they were laws of this kind: if A, then either 1, 2, or 3. So they were not laws like if one thing happens then another thing follows. They were laws along the lines that, given a starting point, there are a finite number of outcomes. Not just one, but not an infinite number, a finite number. And his ideal types consisted of trying to run through this finite number. Different kinds of law, including, say, sacred law. Within sacred law, different sacred laws. So he saw these as sets of possibilities which he would illustrate, and he regarded them as oversimplifications, which were a starting point for getting closer to reality. Now, the thing is, in economy and society, he pushed the process of seeing how far his simple schemata of alternative possibilities got to reality. He pushed that process so far that he was deep into history. So that if I see what he wrote, for example, about medieval canon law, which was not his field particularly, corner of his expertise, but which is part of my field, he is uncannily accurate about it. And in fact, the degree to which he got down to the concrete is extraordinarily impressive in economy and society. So he's both taking you through an analytical riff through, say, the bureaucracies of world history. 3 pages on the bureaucracies of world history. And he will give you the 5 great bureaucracies of world history, and then he will list the differences between them. Now, his method is not meant to be that you have to prove that these things actually existed on the ground, but he gives you this schema, and then he himself tries to make all the qualifications necessary, and he invites you to take that further. So the result is that you have both a set of ideal types of world history, which are then as it were, refined against the concrete realities of world history to such an extent that your sociological ideal types become analytical history. And I think this is more or less where he ended up. So, and by that time, he had lost his exclusive preoccupation with the West, because he had smelt the flesh, if you like, and he had become too interested in the whole thing. And in fact, of course, there is always a personal interest in history. He does say there's always a Wertorientierung, that value freedom goes with a connection to yourself, an existential connection. But I think by the time he knew so much about world history, that had become itself a driving force for him, because how could the whole of world history not be interesting?
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I always see contradiction, but perhaps for just the sake of clarity, Max Weber's Protestant ethic, which is studied by Peter Gosch, is part of his middle life, and he wrote it as sort of articles before he then dived into a long period of depression and illness, and there was a sort of revised edition when he emerged out of that again. And then, so one work which is absolutely central, but it's also central to the middle of his life, and Peter Gosch is studying how, in fact, his life is sort of...
He changes hugely.
Is sort of or a red thread through, and David Darre is concentrating on Wirtschaft und Gesellschaft, which is something which was published posthumously anyway, so which existed only in various forms of articles and pieces, which is very much at the end of his life. But I would like to invite you now to debate across the panel first, before we go into the second round.
Yes. I only really want to make one quite simple point, that that's two simple points. The idea that Weber's intellectual horizons change a lot, that is undoubtedly a widely held view. And in the world, and I hope not too narrow-minded world, of people who write rather exclusively about Weber, this is very much epitomised by Wolfgang Schluchter, and hence by the entire Max Weber Gesamtausgabe, as a matter of fact. I should say that whilst my book has the Protestant ethic in its title, it is a complete intellectual biography of Weber. Let there be no doubt about this. And there's plenty there about economy and society. On the specific point of continuity, this is something I've discussed. And in fact, if you are a careful reader of the original edition of the Protestant Ethic, you will see Weber is making remarks about Confucianism, about Islam, about Talmudic Judaism, and perhaps the most important, Buddhism. Because in the Protestant Ethic, again, readers of the Protestant Ethic will remember that the entity Weber, the principal entity Weber is discussing, is called ascetic Protestantism. And the crucial word, the single most important word there, is not Protestantism, but ascetic. And in the Protestant Ethic, there is already there the central religious typology between asceticism and mysticism, which is crucial to both the sociology of religion and the economic ethics of the world religions. And so I do want to say, and I think the evidence is extremely strong, that as a matter of fact, whilst it's undeniably the case that if you were to read the economic ethics of the world religions, for example, and you read, obviously, 300 pages about Hinduism and Buddhism, of course you're going to get a different impression from reading the Protestant Ethic. That's self-evident. But you can read Weber's economics lectures, which are now, of course, all published from the 1890s, and this is a man who's interested not merely in the frame of reference that appears in the Economic Ethics of the World Religions. This is a man who takes in Latin America before the Spanish arrive. And we should be under no illusions whatsoever about his global horizon. So at this point, actually, I want to agree with you extremely, as it were, perhaps even go a little much further.
Yeah.
The second point I wanted to make was that, and this is where I want to come back, as it were, and be a little bit more agreeable, and also to Joachim Radkar as well. And this, again, is something I've discussed in my book, that the origins of these three very substantial volumes on the economic ethics of the world religions, the origins lie in, so far as we know, about 4 or 5 one-hour lectures. These lectures were such a small-scale event that Marianne Weber never even knew they took place until she read the publication. And the question is, how did you get from 4 one-hour lectures where, in effect, you discussed Islam in an hour, Confucianism in an hour, Buddhism and Hinduism in an hour, how did you get from that situation to where, in fact, as you, I'm sure, know, you get 300 pages on Confucianism, 350, 400 pages on Hinduism and so on. And indeed, the treatment of Judaism is so great that it was never finished. And I entirely agree, there is a disjunction there. But the disjunction is accidental. The disjunction is caused by the First World War. Because at the beginning of the First World War, Weber simply says, well, I'm not going to do economy in society, I can't handle it, and, you know, be serving in the military service, in the hospital service. And he takes up the economic ethics as, again, as Joachim Radkar says, something which undoubtedly delights him. I entirely agree with that. It delights him, and he ends up writing what are, in effect, about 2.7 huge monographs. And there's no question, I entirely take this point, that this is a man who did adore the historically particular. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Nonetheless, the end product that has been produced is certainly not true to his original intention. His original intention was to produce a strictly comparative study, whereas now, as again I trust people in the room know, on average, who reads the book on Confucianism? Answer: Sinologists, above all, not exclusively, but above all. Who reads the book on Indian religion? Answer: Indian specialists. Who reads ancient Judaism? Answer: specialists on the Old Testament or the history of Judaism. And the comparative dimension that Weber wanted to introduce was lost. And I would have to say that whilst he did adore the historically unique, this is actually a failure on his part to fulfil his original scheme.
But it comes in economy and society.
What does, sorry?
The comparison.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, quite so. Quite so.
Only a short remark to your statement. I fully agree that it's also my impression that working on old China and old India, Max Weber lost his preoccupation with the West. My wife is since 20 years adherent of Tibetan Buddhism, and when I sat with her in an Indian restaurant, and I read to her what Max Weber wrote on Buddhism, she cried, "Oh, Max Weber was a Buddhist." And I think you must not only pay attention to Max Weber's thesis, but also to the mode he writes, his language, his style. When Max Weber writes on the Arhat, the illuminated Buddhist, whoever achieves that illumination enjoys bliss here and now. The tone that ancient Buddhism is attuned is triumphant joy. The Arhat who has reached the goal of feels himself replete with strong and delicate objectless and desireless experience of love, free from earthly pride and Philistine self-righteousness, but possessed by an unshakable self-confidence, which guarantees a lasting state of grace, free from fear and within deception. If you know Max Weber, it's exactly a state which he himself would like to have had.
Reached.
Mm. To reach, yes.
Yeah. Well, would you like to go
just very, just
very
really one liner, which I think is, I think there isn't a contradiction because the elements are all there from the beginning, but the balance shifts. As one, because in Economy and Society, there is not that prioritisation of the West. They're in the common frame, but it's not prioritised.
I absolutely cannot agree with that. If you read the opening sentences of the Vorbemerkung, which is the introductory statement that comes at the very beginning of the Economic Ethics of the World Religion, which is written in September 1919, it is absolutely explicit that this is written from an Occidental standpoint with the interests of an Occidental author. This does not mean, in fact, and I should stress this very strongly, that Weber is Eurocentric. Weber simply says, and this is his assumption, he simply says, this is where I am, and it would be unreasonable to suppose that these weren't the criteria that I impose. He never said, ever, that the West was better than the rest. But he did say that if you are a Westerner, you must expect to start your history in the West. And he's absolutely explicit about that.
But not to end there.
Well, this leads us almost, or in the middle of my second round of questions, which is the question of how does Max Weber actually use history, and how do historians think about Max Weber's use of his history? And perhaps I'll start this round with you, Joachim Rathgau. You look back on many decades of encounter with the work of Max Weber, going back to Hallgarten, of course, as I mentioned in the beginning. And one of the, as we have already mentioned, one of the particular aspects now of the uses and functions of the past for Weber seems to be comparison. He wanted to construct comparisons. And to put it with the words of Hans-Ulrich Wehler in Bielefeld, who thinks that the main driving force behind Weber's work was die Eigenart des okzidentalen Gesellschaftstyps durch den Vergleich mit anderen Kulturkreisen möglichst präzise zu erfassen, to understand the peculiarities of the Occidental type of society by comparison with other cultural with other cultures. And the real, or for him, for Weber, the main characteristic of the Occident was rationalization. And I want to ask you what, in your understanding, is the importance of this concept for mm-hmm. Weber and the way of his take on history?
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're right. In former time, I was really torn between Hallgarten and Hans-Ulrich Wehler. They had a completely different view of Max Weber, and they these both really a hatred developed. You can know it. At first I wrote a book together with Hallgarten, who could have been my grandfather, and then Max Weber became my sort of habilitation father. It was a very delicate situation. Not only Hallgarten but also Wehler identified himself absolutely with Max Weber, and at that time in the 70s or 80s for social scientists in Bielefeld, Wehler and Weber were nearly the same. When I once addressed Wehler by mistake as Herr Weber and excused myself, he replied, "Don't worry, you are not the first." Weberian historiography was for Wehler at that time applied systems theory. Though Wieler had surely an immense knowledge of the variety of history, of course, surely Weber, he died this summer, he was no narrow-minded man. In Wieler, in his bestseller, Das Deutsche Kaiserreich, Imperial Germany, he described Imperial Germany as a more and more rigid social political system which increasingly prevented a necessary progress towards modernization and thus became the cause of the German catastrophe. On the contrary, Hallgarten, born in 1901 into a family with a lot of connections with the Wilhelminian elite, but he was incredibly also a classmate and even friend of Heinrich Himmler, the later SS chief. He was of Jewish origin, a youth friend of Himmler. Absolutely grotesque. Hallgarten described the way into World War I as an outcome of deep social political tensions, not of outcome of a system, but outcome of a deep tensions, which led to a politic, sowohl als auch, incapable of a clear and consequent line because of divergent social group interests, and therefore exploding in the end into a war against all sides, against Russia, France, Great Britain, the United States, and even Italy. Hallgarten constructed history in his Weberian way, not so much by systems, but more by deep tensions. And today, I think, in this regard, he was a better Weberian than Wieler. This may have been discussed in Paris with Michel Lallemand. He also wrote a book on Weber, Tension Majeure, great tensions. And Hallgarten's historiography is full of vivid and colorful persons, also here in sharp contrast to Wieler, but closer to Weber. I think Kirchhoff mocked that in the five big volumes of Weber's Deutsche Gesellschaftsgeschichte, only Bismarck and Hitler are really vivid persons, but elsewhere only systems. Hallgarten's monumental drama of imperialism appears to me like a combination of Max Weber and Richard Wagner, whose operas again and again haunted his imagination, but also in Weber's mind you find traces of the Wagnerian world. And I was informed a British historian, Tim Blenning, wanted to write even a whole book about Max Weber and Richard Wagner. I would be very, very, very curious on this book. And as to rationality, Hallgarten, I think from Hallgarten I learned the creative use of the Weberian concept of rationality, which I could hardly learn at the usual rather abstract sociological conferences on the themes. It seems to me that many theoretical sociologists neglected what Weber himself emphasized in his later addictions to the Protestant ethic. If this essay makes any contribution at all, may it be to bring out the complexity, vielseitigkeit, of the only superficially simple concept of the rational. Hallgarten knew well that the Weberian rational had little to do with the rational choice theory. There I also agree with you. And I think of the cold skelet hände des rationalen, cold skeleton hands of the rational in the famous Zwischenbetrachtung, intermediate reflection. In no way rationalization marked for Weber the mainstream to human progress. And Hallgarten, I think in a very Weberian manner, conceived the tragedy of the Weimar Republic, not at least as a tragedy of rationalization, rationalisierung, typical German catchword of that time. This rationalization boom of the 20s intensified the economic crisis of the following years, which was a precondition for the Nazi siege of power. That's a long time I stop.
So, you think Halgarten had a better understanding of rationality, or Weber's take on rationality and rationalization than Wähler and other modern historians.
Today I can say it frankly, both are dead.
But David Dambray, I mean, you have now written an awful lot on Weber and rationality, and you use the Weberian categories of rationality in a strictly non-developmental interest, you are interested in the ideal types as tools of understanding. And But to a certain extent, you also, of course, as a historian, one is always interested in historical development, and you are interested perhaps in, if I understood you right, it's also what changes is the constellations of rationalities. And in this context, you take also issue with Max Weber's classification of medieval papacy as the first rational bureaucracy, and you show that changes happened slightly differently. And I just wanted to ask you now, with your hat as a medievalist, in what sense do you think Weber helps to understand change, and what was his use here adequate of use of history? I mean, you've already said he was absolutely accurate about canon law.
I think there are two things to focus on. Firstly, this one example you said about the papacy, and I think that that's quite useful. And then secondly, about the types of rationality in his vocabulary, which I think ended up finally being very clear. But firstly, now, with the papacy, I was particularly using the work of a German historian, Brigida Schwarz, which seems to me almost like a model of how to use Weber, because she did a study of papal government in which she took Weber's ideal type of bureaucracy and used it as a questionnaire. And what she found was that most of the items on his checklist for bureaucracy were absent from the medieval papacy. Now, in doing that, she was being a perfect Weberian. It's about the best example I know of Weberian method, and Weber would have clapped, because that's precisely how he intended his method to be used.
Yes.
And he would have been delighted. That is the ideal type method. And I was piggybacking off that and saying that the medieval papacy is Weberian in its use of formal legal rationality, but not in its bureaucracy. It found alternatives to bureaucracy. That is the Weberian method of work. So that was not a criticism of Weber. It was totally in the spirit of him. Now, as for rationality in general, there are three concepts to distinguish. I mean, more than three, but three especially. There's rationalization, then there's Zweckrationalität, instrumental rationality, and then there's Wertrationalität, value rationality. And Zweckrationalität is indeed almost the same as rational choice rationality. And it's what most people mean by rationality when they use the word. The distinctive thing about Weber, and I think this is what really marks him out from everybody else, is he saw that the Zweckrationalität, the instrumental rationality, was shaped entirely by the contours of the value rationality in which it fitted. So you do indeed find processes of rationalization, but their nature is determined by the values within which they evolve. This is how he's able to say that Indian asceticism is the most rationalized asceticism. Its rationalization is within the context of the value system of Hinduism. And within that context, there is development. So within any value rationality, there is indeed development, but there is no cumulative development, at least that we can see, for history in general. Now, he began by being particularly interested in the value rationale, in the instrumental rationality and the rationalization of the West. But then I think his interests extended much more broadly to the same phenomena of rationalization within the contours of a value system. wherever he found it, often within religious value systems. And his concept of value rationality is his most important concept, I think, the way in which that generates all the other kinds of rationality. And he didn't use the word an awful lot, but I think the end of his life, at the end of his thought, that is what is kind of the key concept that's driving the other concepts.
Yeah, thank you. And Peter, perhaps I go back to the Protestant ethic again, and there's an awful lot of debate on whether Weber got it right, and I don't know how many volumes there are on the Protestant ethic, probably at least. I went through the library today, there was basically a whole shelf full of historical works trying to see whether it was really right or wrong, and whether it started a lot earlier, capitalism, and so on and so forth. And you explicitly say that's not really what interests you, these debates, whether he got the facts right in detail. But what then is your perspective, the role of history, if it doesn't really matter whether he got the facts right or wrong?
Oh, well,
uh-huh. I mean, that's perhaps overstating it, but what do you think is the role of the past, of using the past?
Yes. Let me just take the thing you've just said, because it links back to what David was saying.
Yeah.
And this is just to prove that, you know, we haven't arranged this all in advance, but this is something I agree with you very strongly, that Weber is quite emphatic that the work he's doing is to a very high degree conceptual construction. But he's, again, absolutely explicit. He says, well, of course, once you have made a conceptual construction, you then give it to the specialists to test. He didn't for a moment believe that somehow he could assert that your concepts are all right. By definition, they have to be tested against empirical reality, and I believe that's exactly what David was saying. And I do think that's an immensely important point. And one of the many deceptive things about the Protestant ethic is precisely the fact, of course, it has this enormous battery of footnotes. And, you know, if you were to construct a bibliography, which obviously has been done, it's very long. And people have assumed from this, with much, you know, very forgivably so, that this is, of course, is a historical statement which is complete in itself. And that's a complete mistake. The Protestant ethic is very strictly a conceptual construction, which then, he says, should be tested. Conveniently for Weber, his idea of who should do the empirical testing was Ernst Troeltsch, and who is closely associated with Weber in Heidelberg. I wouldn't say by any stretch they agreed on everything, but they had quite a lot of agreement about how you worked. And so the first edition of the Protestant Ethic is these two long journal articles, 1904-1905. In 1907, Ernst Troeltsch begins work on what is commonly recognised as really his magnum opus, which is called Social Teachings of the Christian Churches and Groups. And there is no question that Weber is very important in triggering this inquiry, and that enormous amounts of the material, the Soziallehren, is easily 800 pages. Enormous amounts of the material are very recognisably Weberian materials. And at the end of the day, Troeltsch said, well, actually, yes, you know, I'm quite in agreement with Weber's history. He didn't say, although it's actually perfectly obvious, that he disagreed with him root and branch on, in fact, conceptual matters. Anyway, coming back more narrowly to the Protestant ethic itself, because originally when I first started work on it, I was so impatient. I thought, you know, oh, this awful material where these people come along and they say, oh, it's all wrong. that I'm sure people in the audience will be familiar perhaps with, to be fair, the quite sophisticated inquiries by Gordon Marshall circa 1980. And then much more recently, of course, the sadly deceased German historian Heinz Steinert, sociologist Heinz Steinert. And it's clear that the historical status of the Protestant ethic is still very much, to me, a surprisingly alive topic. And what I would like to say about this is first of all, is that I'm afraid I make no retreat in my condemnation of the quality of this critical literature. It's largely conducted not by historians, but by sociologists pretending to be historians. And it's clear from this that they have an unbelievably reductive idea of what history involves, which is to say, what you do is you take a piece of evidence Weber cites, and then you check it and say, well, has he cited it accurately? This is criticism of an extraordinary literal kind. And the idea that, you know, all that historical writing involves is simply taking bits of evidence and somehow sort of putting them together is obviously nonsense. It's also true, and this is very, very important, that if you look at what the critics, even just the evidence they take, because they simply don't confront Weber's ideas in any serious way, it's not systematic at all. And anybody who wants to look at an essentially systematic critique of the Protestant ethic at a purely evidential level can now do so thanks to the Gesamtausgabe, because now the edition of the original text of Protestant ethic has been published, and one of the functions of the collected edition is precisely to look at the use of sources. It's true, you either need about £300 or a library to do it, but it can be done. And of course, the picture that comes out of a really serious, systematic scrutiny like that is entirely different to this, I have to say, rather cheapjack criticism. Not least because the person who did the editorial work was a theologian, and there's no question whatsoever that the principal sources used for Protestant ethic are theological sources. And Weber himself says in 1907 that the source from where he expects to get the most informed criticism is from a theologian, meaning Ernst Troeltsch. Having said all of that, this tells us we haven't got to the point, obviously the important point, which I think is where Andreas wants me to get to, is, well, so what are the historical claims of the Protestant ethic? And at an elementary, at the most primitive level, I have some sympathy with the critics. The critics want to say, although they don't formulate it quite like this, that what they want to say is, this is not conventional empirical history as we know it. Of course it isn't. Why would anybody waste any time writing a whole book saying that when Weber tells you he is not a conventional empirical historian? I said, one of the oddities about the critics is that the only Weber text they read is the Protestant ethic. The idea that you would read all of Weber's statements about methodology and how he's actually working is not something that apparently occurs to them. But if you want what, to my mind, is the simplest possible illustration of the oddity of the Protestant ethic in a conventional historical light, I don't know, David would be interested in what David has to say about this, is if you consider the central unit under scrutiny in the Protestant ethic is something called ascetic Protestantism. Now, unless I'm much mistaken, I've never read a conventional empirical history of the Reformation which ever suggested the central religious party of the Reformation was called the ascetic Protestants. Lutherans, yes. Calvinists, yes. Catholics, yes, etc. But not ascetic Protestants. And this tells you straight away that, of course, this is Weber's idea, and he's doing what he said he was doing. He's making up his own concepts. As I said, this is this point he goes back to again and again and again. My perspectives. As a matter of fact, what interests us?
Can I?
Yes, yeah. Please.
I want to come in on the my concepts thing, because this is very central, I think, to his methodology. If you think of historians, on the one hand, there's the concepts of the people they study.
Yes, exactly.
And historians sometimes go a long way with that. Otto Brunner's Land und Herrschaft is a systematic attempt just to use the concepts of the people he studies. Nonetheless, if you're studying inflation in the ancient world, how can you study it when they don't have the concept of inflation? It makes no sense. Then there's the concepts of our society in general, our discourse, our world, how we navigate through our world. Now, then finally, there are academic concepts, ideal types, such as Weber invents. And this is a third category, because these are tools for a specific purpose of academic analysis. And of course, in that sense, they are a product of our society, they're a product of our world of academic historians and sociologists. But they're not a product of our society in the sense of our society. They are any more than the concepts used by a crystallographer are. I mean, they come from our society. Crystallography is a product of our society. But the technical concepts they use are purpose-built for analytical purposes. And Weber's ideal types are such concepts, and they're deliberately freed as far as possible from the looseness and also the colouring of values, the sneaking in through the back door of assumptions of the concepts of everyday life in our society. They're purpose-built to be value-free analytical concepts.
Ooh, dear me, dear me.
This is what he says in his great theoretical essay.
I have to say,
Herschel and Nice and all the rest of it.
I think it's true. If you really, really want to get a good discussion going, once you start getting to Weber's methodology, we could be here for a very long time. I think we have to be careful that the way you just presented it is very attractive. I wouldn't deny that for a moment. And that Weber undoubtedly does say, very explicitly, these concepts are my concepts, which is not indeed the same thing as saying these are the concepts of the society. Having said that, nonetheless, he is utterly insistent that, in fact, whatever, in his view, any particular branch of science of Wissenschaft is interested, is in fact driven by the Kultur of his own day.
It's wertbezogen, but wertfrei. That's the distinction.
That's quite true.
It's got an existential... You ask a question because you have an interest in it.
Yes.
Then you develop concepts which are value-free and you pursue your investigation in a value-free way.
That's absolutely correct. The only point I wanted to take up is that I think at the end of the day, Weber undoubtedly, the ideal types he frames are undoubtedly, you're quite right, they have a so-called value point of reference.
But that's why you're interested. You don't study something
exactly.
Unless you're interested in it.
No, quite so.
But then
quite right,
after
yes.
That, you leave
yes.
That behind.
Oh, absolutely. No, of course. I agree with that entirely. But all I want to say is that nonetheless, we mustn't go so far as to say we mustn't overestimate his detachment from his society. That he is quite conscious that the starting point, only the starting point,
yeah.
Does lie in the culture of his own day.
Or even of the individual.
Or even, well, and that's an ambiguity he never resolved.
Yeah.
Another topic. Only a short remark to David Devery. What you told about the manner Brigitte Schwarz treated liberian concepts. I think if we use Max Weber and his concept, we should not always have the aim to prove Max Weber is right, Max Weber knows best. We should also sometimes say the Max Weber approach in this case is not
that is a betrayal of Max Weber to try and prove he's
yeah,
right.
Yes, exactly.
Of Max Weber.
As to me, I must confess that at first I had in my heart the ambition to become a green Max Weber by displaying the intimate connection between Protestant ethic and the spirit of environmentalism. to be sure, in the in the environmental history is my main topic in the last decades. To be sure, at the roots of environmentalism, you find a lot of spiritual motives, much fear of apocalyptic collapse, and you find also charismatic moments and charismatic leaders. Best example, Rudolf Bahr, one of the founding fathers of the German Green Party, declared on a meeting, on a green meeting in Hamburg, December 1984, the race against the apocalypse can be won only if this becomes a great age of faith, a Pentecostal season in which the living spirit pours out over everyone. Whoa! But the point is that this spiritualism was quite unstable, quite second-hand and confused, and drove its followers more and more away. Not really an effective charisma. Barrow started in East Germany as an admirer of Martin Luther, then jumped to Meister Eckhart, to Spinoza, to Buddha and others, until he turned to Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh with his tantric sexual practices. And the last shock he gave to the Greens was his call for a green Adolf. Terrible. When I later on was asked, what is your message on the history of environmentalism, I told the message, it's more or less a new enlightenment, not a quasi-religious charismatic movement. But in the backside, sitting my old friend and former assistant, Frank Ueketer, and I think perhaps we'll make a struggle in the Journal of World History, a panel where I play the anti-barbarian and she plays the better barbarian, perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps we take this as a sign to open briefly up to the floor, and then come back with a last round here on the panel. What are the perspectives of historical research with the help and the spirit of Max Weber? But first of all, I would like to just simply ask you to come in and join the debate. Now we have some microphones.
Audible. Jeffrey Hoskin, Emeritus Professor of Russian History at UCL. It's really many decades ago since I read Weber, but I think somehow his ideas have remained at the back of my mind. But one question I have is, am I not right in believing that his first chair was in the history of law, or it had some connection with law? Now, what I've been wondering throughout this debate is, what is the connection of law, both his interest in positive law, and then in the connection between law, ethics, religion, and so on? How does this interest manifest itself in his work?
Anyone?
Yes.
I mean, again, allow me to say, at the risk of self-advertisement, this is something I've devoted a chapter in my book to. It's very important that the law in which he was expert was Roman law and therefore private law, not public law. And the crucial thing, as I understand it, he got out of this, and I'm listening to David Averill, I'm thinking we're going to be very much in agreement here, is that in his own day, German private law is conceived of as something which is formally and logically very perfect. And there's this frequent statement that the judge is like an automaton, because the system is already so refined and so highly polished that, in fact, all, you know, you simply feed in the evidence and the answer comes out automatically. And this is this crucial distinction to which David Averill has alluded that in a lot of Weberian thought, is to think very carefully about that which is operating at a formal level. And my belief is, and as I said, I do think the evidence is pretty strong for this, that most of Weber's innovations in methodology derive from the idea of legal formalism. So the idea of formal rationality, the idea of the ideal type as something which is formally and logically perfect. These are all ideas which I think are essentially come from law. And you're absolutely right, and I think this is something that biographers tend to overlook. Again, there's a degree of departmental patriotism here, but basically between 1884 and 1894, which is a long time, Weber is basically being a lawyer. And what, again, what actually, as you may recall, happens is that in 1895 he then moves across to economics. And not surprisingly, of course, the economists think this is utterly wonderful. And I think there's some sense, perhaps, in the literature that, you know, economics is somehow a more late 20th century subject or something. It's more relevant. But the simple biographical point that comes out of this is that if you then ask yourself, well, what happened to him when he was being an economist? The answer was, of course, a complete psychological meltdown. And actually, he's only an economist for about 3 years. Before he has this as a colossal collapse.
Of course, Professor Radkow would say that was for different reasons, but still.
Yes, indeed.
Can I pick up on the law thing?
Yeah. Yes, please do.
I think his original interest in law is he was looking for all the different explanations for the rise of capitalism. And he quite reasonably said one of the explanations is if you have a law which enables you to predict what will happen, so you know whether your debts will be paid, so you know what's legal and what isn't, that will work better for rational capitalism as opposed to gambler capitalism or patronage capitalism. That was his original interest. Though the Roman law, he says explicitly, he thinks that English common law is more rational than Roman law and more expensive. He says it's a great law for the rich. And he says every English company has its legal father confessor to whom it can go to. Because and his point is that the common law actually is also formally rational with its system of precedents, but it's much more expensive because you need to know a lot more to get that legal consistency. So it's not just Roman law. In fact, he actually thinks English common law is more rational and more conducive to capitalism. But then from that, he gets to the whole conspectus of different kinds of law. And in Economy and Society, what you get, in effect, is a universal history of law in which he goes through all the different types and gives a pretty decent history of each kind.
Sorry, could I make just one tiny point there? Actually, if I may say so, he does not say that English law is rational.
Yes, he does.
No?
I've written
no.
the paper.
So, this is
I'm not going to back down on that.
This is Weber's English problem.
I'm not going to back down.
Okay, well,
I've published on it. I can tell you.
You must please give me the reference.
So, the English. I think we solved the English Weber's English problem afterwards over a glass of wine.
Yes.
Do you want to come in on the law?
Yes. Of course, you are right. Max Weber started in law, but became his desire to move away from law. At one time, he complained he was an den öden Felsen der Juristerei geschmiedet. He was chained at the bare rock of law. But to be sure, his life, he continued a certain sharp style of argument, a sharp style of terms. He undoubtedly he was influenced by his training of law. You said you came from Russian studies.
Yes.
There's a very interesting point. You know, Weber in 1905 began to write on the Russian Revolution.
Yes, I certainly do. My PhD was on the Russian Duma, so
I had to.
Two very long months of the constitutional setup in Russia, 1956. Yes.
You know, my hobby is Max Weber and nature. Well, 1 or 2 months ago, I held a paper in Moscow on Max Weber, Russia and nature. It's especially interesting. Max Weber called the Russian Revolution of 1905. Max Weber was mainly interested in the peasant revolution, not in the intellectual revolution. They called it the last of the world's natural law-oriented agrarian revolutions. I think the issue of natural law is very, very interesting, Max Weber.
It's very interesting law, that's why you wrote about constitutions. Yeah. It was actually called constitutionalism in the essay.
Pseudo-constitutions.
I try to prove Max Weber in his heart was an adherent of natural law, but also is somewhat disguised. Leo Strauss, also a German refugee of 1933, later attacked in the whole book Max Weber as being a foe of natural law, but I think that's not at all true. But that's a topic for an own lecture.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Theo Jung. I'm from Freiburg University. I would like to come back to this concept of rationality and the multiplicity of concepts of rationality in Weber. And I think one of the things of value in his work is that he shows that there are multiple forms of rationality that have their own paths of development. Mm. But I was wondering, what does Weber say about situations where multiple forms of rationality collide or are in competition with one another? And can one describe what happens there also in terms of rationality? So it is the more successful type of rationality in its competition with other types, the more rational kind?
No.
And would that be a form of rationalization?
Firstly, Peter Gosch rightly alludes to it's like the war of the gods, and the fact that this is, the different rationalities are like a war of the gods. It's very much one of the problems I address in my Rationalities in History, precisely this. And one of the main points I make is that, on the whole, value rationalities, because that's what we're talking about, have a great immunity to each other. They defend themselves very well. But every now and again, there is a weak spot. And, for example, Hinduism is entirely unaffected by Western liberalism, industrialism, etc. It's not a problem. Confucian, Imperial China, is vulnerable to it because, for them, their ethos also produces material success. So the extraordinary military and industrial power of the West is a threat to the Confucian worldview in a way that it's not to the Hindu worldview. So there are particular cases where, you, as it were, a shot gets under the waterline. But it's not because one is more rational than another. On the whole, the number of competing value rationalities in the world are very able to defend themselves. You think of Islam and liberal individualism. Within each, the other seems evidently absurd, and neither of them convince each other. So there is no common ground. But what does happen is that there are no two rationalities which fail to overlap at some points. Think, for example, of Russia and the United States in the 1960s. Apparently, two completely contrasting worldviews. They both believe in monogamy. That whole vast area of overlap, which is quite unusual in world history. They both believe in monogamy. And where they overlap, they both believe in organization too, where they overlap, then they can convince each other. So most debate goes in the areas where value rationalities overlap with each other. Where they clash is where they hit the hard cores. And that doesn't always happen.
One could say in the short sentence, Max Weber was not Jürgen Habermas. Max Weber.
Thank goodness.
Please.
Thank goodness.
surely Max Weber did not believe that the great tensions, conflicts on the world could be solved by Herrschaftsfreie Diskurs, by this discourse. Just I discovered your chapter on Habermas. Also Habermas at Max Weber is interesting theme. In his older years, Habermas got more and more serious.
He would have thought that there was one rationality that could convince everybody else. Yes, wrongly.
But Weber had always the tendency to see politics in the sense is struggle. But I think that's also a wake point of Weber. Politics is not only struggle, politics is also a skillful finding of consensus. But that was not, consensus did not belong to the skills of Max Weber.
May I? Documentary correction here. Very, very important. Remember, let us go back to a very famous Weber letter which says the scholar must never compromise, the politician must always compromise. And in fact, very interestingly, although, and Wolfgang, may I say, a big sort of metaphorical round of applause for Wolfgang Mommsen, a really great historian, and although Mommsen wanted to make out originally, but he then in fact refined his point of view immensely, that Weber was apparently quite an aggressive nationalist. In fact, Weber was the sort of nationalist, he was a nationalist, nobody would deny that, but he was the sort of nationalist who was bright enough to realise that if he was a German nationalist, then across the Rhine there were some French nationalists. And he understood that nationalism was in fact not merely a two-way street, but about a sort of a 16-way street, or if you like, in the European great powers, a five-way street. So we need to be very, very careful about this word Kampf.
Because Weber, in fact, in one
of his more conventional sides, is that he is a sort of a great liberal individualist. And he certainly does believe that we should all rub off each other by vigorously arguing our points of view. And that's Kampf. Kampf isn't necessarily fighting. It's surely a real mental struggle. Yeah.
Chris from King's College London. Can we please come back to the notion of the ideal time? And we've heard a lot about Weber's own ideas, but less about the relevance and application of his ideas for those of us writing history now. I'd just like to say, in my own PhD research, I found Weber's ideas extremely helpful. Not as you described in the way that Schwarz, I think it was, taking a ready-made ideal type off the shelf and testing it, but as a British and critical historian, trying to answer the question, and how do we move from the empirical to the general, and how can we make sense from the massive data that we have available to us and make it intelligible to other people? And I have to say, the only writings of Weber that I've read are on the ideal type, so I know nothing about anything else he's written. But what I say is based on Die Objektivität sozialwissenschaftlicher Erkenntnis. And it seemed to me that in that he's saying very clearly that, as I see it, the ideal type is not like a law. It has no objective reality. It's not a hypothesis. It's not a schema to use for classification. It's certainly not in any way the essence of reality. It has no causal effect in its own right as an idea, certainly no teleological dynamic within history in a Hegelian or Marxist sense. It's simply there to make the external objective world intelligible to the rest of us from the perspective that we have in our current lives today. Now that's sort of my understanding of the use and relevance, and this seems to me that for those of us who approach history from an empirical point of view, Weber seemed to be saying not only this is one way, but this is the only way to make the objective world intelligible and meaningful to different people, because we all have our own different perspectives, and he said explicitly there are lots of different ideal types and anyone can come up with their own ideal type. So I'd sort of welcome the panel's comments on that view of the relevance of Weber's ideas to current writing of history, particularly from those of us in a British empirical tradition.
I'm thinking this is the thing that you really do.
It is pretty much what I do. You're right. He doesn't think of them as laws in the normal sense, though he thinks of them as laws quite like what is called the law of supply and demand. So the law of supply and demand is, if the price goes down, more people will buy it. However, it's not actually a law like a law of physics, because it doesn't always happen. Sometimes, in the art market, for example, people will only buy something if the price goes up. Or sometimes, if it's an expensive perfume, if the price goes down, then fewer people will buy it because its core market is people who regard themselves as exclusive. So it's something that's a sort of a rational expectation is one kind of ideal type, but it's not a law. Now, you're quite right. He did think of ideal types as being essentially a way of dealing with the infinite complexity of the world. Though I would see it as almost the starting point. Rather, you were talking almost as though you start with this complexity and then to try and explain it to others, you use an ideal type. Whereas I think you put it even more fundamentally, that before you get into the complexity, you've got to have a sketch map. So an ideal type is very much like a rough sketch map, which you then progressively refine. So it's a simplification that gets you into the detail. But it's a very rich concept, because it's more than that. If you take something like Geoffrey Hosking's book on trust that he's just published, he is writing about trust in universal history. It's actually a very Weberian kind of work. And what he says is that there are three kinds of organizations that have been particularly successful in generating trust: religious organizations, some economic capitalist organizations like the stock exchange, and nation states. Now, he's not saying these are the only sorts of things that generate trust, but if you're approaching trust in human history, this is a pretty good simplification to begin with, and then you can progressively refine it. So the ideal types work fine for history of just one period, but also that you can do more of that. They're very well adapted to comparative history, precisely because they are not concepts for one particular period. So let's say if you're studying magic and religion, you can study that in Western Europe and use the concepts of Western Europe. If you're studying it in Africa and you want to use Evans Pritchard, you know, he writes a book about the religion of the Nuer and he writes a book about magic and the Azandi. How do you know that it shouldn't be the magic of the Nuer and the religion of the Azandi? You have to have an ideal type as a neutral third term to even be able to draw comparisons. So it does everything you say, but it does more as well, I think.
That's a very interesting point. And I think the ideal types underlines that anthropology is at the core of Weberian later thinking, and also the conviction there is something like a human nature, a nature of human relations. Horst Beyer, one of the editors of the Max Weber Gesamtausgabe, wrote in his habilitation work on this topic, and he showed that the Weberian ideal type is most in common with biological thinking. The ideal type is not only the construction of certain minds, it's also rooted in reality. He writes, Goethe was the first to work typologically with morphological studies of plants and animals with the ideal types. And similarly, Helmut Plessner, also a very fine thinker on Max Weber, also of the older generation, of the later Max Weber generation. The ideal type is a way of escaping the straitjacket of a split between nature and culture. I think these remarks are for me are one of the keys for understanding of Max Weber.
No, yes, go for it. Yeah.
I just want to throw in a more plebeian response. I very much in agreement with David. I think the ideal type, the number of ideas Weber has going on there is really quite a lot. And I always think it's worth bearing in mind what was the historiographical predicament from which this emerged. We need to go back to, this is the generation of the 1890s, and this is when this pernicious word, or deliberately pejorative word, sorry, not pernicious, pejorative word, historismus, comes in, which means basically just means that, you know, what is history? Well, effectively, the historical data set is infinite, and because you can't prove anything, then everything becomes relative. And Weber obviously is not alone in understanding that if the data set is completely infinite and way beyond the resources any human society would ever devote to processing even fractions of it, then, of course, historians have a problem. And I do think, you know, that in itself is a very good reason for reading Weber, to understand that this is the predicament we're all in, even whether or not we routinely acknowledge it. And, of course, Weber's answer in the Essay on Objectivity, and this is a mantra he repeats about 8 or 9 times, where he says, well, what is social science? And he says it's the mental construction of empirical reality. And that's, in my view, an exactly half and half statement. 50% is the empirical reality, 50% is the mental construction. And when he's not... allow me to point out that, in fact, the exposition of the ideal type in the Objectivity Essay is the only ever exposition he made of it. That doesn't mean he abandoned it or anything like that, but it is to say that if you, as perhaps you may well have done, if you've looked at something like Science as a Vocation, he doesn't talk about the ideal type there. I said this is my plebeian point. He goes slightly down mark and he says, well, okay, so you have the concept. And I do feel that sometimes, because the ideal type is such a rich topic, there's a virtue in saying, well, okay, so there's an infinity of empirical material, and then there's the concept. And because he, in Science as a Vocation, of course, he says, this is like a vice. You know, this is something which will really do work for you. And I want to say, well, we could talk about ideal types, but why not talk about the concept in a more humble way?
But you could say, Economy and Society, Wirtschaft und Gesellschaft, is a handbook of ideal types. It's all ideal types which, in some cases, get so refined that there is no difference from history. I do disagree, though, with any connection between any attempt to assimilate ideal types to, say, classification in biology, because Linnaean classification, all the rest of it, this is saying these are the actual types in reality, whereas Weber is not saying that. He's saying this is a simplification, ideas of rational behaviour, and then let us see how far that gets us a grip on reality, expecting them to be constantly corrected. And also, not corrected in a sort of Popperian sense, not in the way that you falsify a law, because they're not those sorts of laws. That you correct them piecemeal, you water them down as you apply them. It's quite different from verification and falsification. It's a matter of taking a rough sketch map and progressively making it more accurate and more detailed.
Well, with Chris Noel's question, we were also already in our last round of questions, really, where I wanted to ask what is actually the future of historical research based or applying Weberian problematics or also methodology. And you wanted to become the Green Weber, Joachim Radko. So perhaps we could start. What do you think is the relevance of Weber and his way of thinking and his methodology for future historiography? You remarked yourself that modern sociologists don't read Weber anymore. It's Luhmann and others are more fashionable at the moment. What do you think, from your perspective?
Yes, I fully agree with you. It's up to us historians today to rediscover Max Weber, to revitalize him. Some weeks ago, I sat together in Bielefeld University with several colleagues of sociology, half a dozen, I think, and I asked, what have you read of Max Weber? Always the sociologische Grundbegriffe, basic terms of sociology, nothing else. And no wonder that Weber's popularity has been declining since a long time among sociologists. You cannot gain a real passion for Max Weber by only if you only read sociologische Grundbegriffe.
For historians.
The richness of Weber's work, I think, can only be discovered when one also has a historical libido. For example, the famous Zwischenbetrachtung, intermediate reflection, or the famous Zwischenbetrachtung, where Max Weber has the basic idea and repeated it in Wirtschaft und Gesellschaft, also later on. that the removal of modern man from the organic cycle of natural existence introduces a deep tension into the whole of life, and presumably borrowed from Leo Tolstoy. Just because of this detachment is never complete, and in some way man always remains a national creature in his physical being. And this was for me an excellent starting point for writing universal environmental history. But that's not the only way to rediscover, revitalize Max Weber. There may be many ways, but you must have a sense for the immense variety of history in order to fully enjoy Max Weber, I think.
I'm probably not the best person to ask this question, but I have a thought that I'm a historian of ideas, and this comes back to something David Darrow was saying. And so, inevitably, when I'm studying a subject, I'm saying, okay, I want to know what are the categories these people were employing at the time. And I like to think, I hope that's a reasonably fruitful approach, but, and this is very, very important, this is where I'm delighted that I'm going to agree, it is obviously undoubtedly the case that the lives people live are not exhausted by the categories they carry around in their head. And as a matter of fact, the illustration that comes to my mind, but as a matter of fact, he is a colleague, is a medieval historian, Chris Wickham. This is a subject we in fact discussed, because he rapidly picked up on the fact that, you know, he said, oh, you're only interested in what people carry around their heads, but, you know, there are other things going on. And he made precisely the point that you made, that, you know, he's written these big, big socioeconomic histories of medieval Europe. And I freely accept that he does have a very important point, that what people lived is greater than what they think, and that these are subjects which it is fully open to us, therefore, to construct. And I don't need to tell anybody in this room that even if I said to the contrary, nobody would believe me. For example, you know, do we have gender history or do we have gender history? We do. And I like to think that, in fact, whilst, again, it's unrealistic to suppose that women throughout history were in fact thinking in the way they were thinking in late 20th century Europe or America, nonetheless, that is still a fruitful means of proceeding. So then is the $64 question, well, how are you going to use Weber? And I said, this is where I really think I will defer to others, but my thought here is that I think the best borrowings are in many ways quite simple borrowings, which still leaves plenty of room open for the person doing the borrowing to mould the thing they've taken to their own concerns. I'm ashamed to say I haven't read your books, but
I've had a good read at yours.
In Chris Wickham's case, I mean, obviously, what Chris is using what we might call Marxist concepts, although, again, they're so universal that it's slightly ridiculous, but, you know, like class. But my point is, you know, when you're reading what he's written, you shouldn't be saying, what did Marx say about class? You should be saying, A, what is Chris Wickham's history? And B, what does he think about class? And in that way, I do believe that these things can be carried on. Although my final point, sorry, I mustn't go on too long, is that the aspect of Weber's historical thought that I personally find most fruitful are his general reflections on the status of the historical inquiry as a whole. But that's a purely personal point of view.
Chris Wickham, I think, although he's sort of tagged as a Marxist, is very much a Weberian in his analysis, there's no doubt about that. I think Weber is very unusual among historians and sociologists in that he is interesting enough himself as an intellect to be worth biographies by people like Professor Rad Kao and Peter Gosch. Most historians just are not so interesting as intellectuals, and sociologists too. And that can be, I mean, to be studied as an intellectual history in the same way that you might do an intellectual history of Hegel. And I think Weber actually is a fascinating study as an intellect in his own right. And this is what I think is the real attraction for you, is that he is a major figure in intellectual history in his own right. So he's an object of historical study. As for the rest, I'd say one example and then one generalisation. So the example is, I've just finished a study of papacy, monarchy and marriage. Trying to explain why divorces or annulments get harder and harder to the point of impossibility for kings, and dispensations become easier and easier. Now, Weber's concepts of instrumental rationality and value rationality explain that perfectly. Dispensations are in the realm of instrumental rationality. Annulments are in the realm of value rationality. So that concept explains that. Then secondly, the generalization. I think Weber's fundamental question by the end of his life is, historians should always be asking this: how unusual is what I'm studying in world history? How unusual is what I'm studying in world history? If you think of it, the moment you ask that question, if it is not unusual, you've already got a generalization, a sociological generalization. Because if something has happened in other times or places, then a local explanation is not enough. So let's say witch persecutions. We have explanations for witch persecutions in early modern Europe. But we know that witch persecutions are going on in Africa, notably South Africa, at this moment, in a form extremely similar to those in early modern Europe. So any explanation which is specific to early modern Europe cannot be a valid or at least a complete explanation. So we ask that. But then sometimes we find something that is unique in world history, and then we want to explain why it is. And this, of course, it can be a big thing like capitalism, or it can be a small thing like a completely unique social system in an African tribe. But either way, I think for him, this is the key question. How unique is my subject, my topic in world history? And that's what we should take from him.
Yeah, wonderful. I think it's a brilliant summary, and it also marks the difference between enterprises like that of Hans-Ulrich Wehler in German history, who constructed a multi-volume German history, mainly written in Weberian categories, but in a very clear national framework. And I think the British outlook might be probably more global and the more, in many ways, more empirical and less, how should I phrase it properly, less dogmatic in scope. Anyway, Max Weber came from a Huguenot family. Protestant asceticism was part of his family life, but I don't know whether Joachim Radka has written on his alcohol consumption. Is that a problem?
There's also several
phases. Anyway, it goes in phases, but we have now a glass of wine next door, and we can continue the discussion on all problems, Max Weber and the rest of the world. And I would like to thank you very much for coming, but particularly I would like to thank the personalities in Weberian sense who have guided through this evening and through a lively debate and shared their expertise with us. So thank you very much for taking part, and now you're all invited for a glass of wine. Thank you very much.